Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service, with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
I was skeptical about ordering foundation online. I can't even find a match in stores. Then I discovered Il Makiage. Their online quiz found my exact shade in seconds. With Try Before You Buy, you can try your full-size shade at home free for 14 days. But I was obsessed on day one. It's so lightweight and natural, it's literally my skin in a bottle. Take the quiz at ilmakiage.com/quiz. That's ilmakiage.com/quiz.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Alex Ritson, and in the early hours of Tuesday, the 21st of July, these are our main stories. Encouraging results have been reported from early trials of a coronavirus vaccine developed by Oxford University. State-run shops in Cuba are once again selling some goods in US dollars as the country's currency crisis deepens. Also in this podcast, the UK suspends its extradition treaty with Hong Kong as relations with China worsen, and
this is the first time that anybody has really established a timeline for when polar bears are likely to disappear.
A warning that the poster species of climate change could be gone by the end of the century. Since the earliest days of the coronavirus pandemic, scientists around the world have been racing to produce a vaccine to stop its spread. Now, a report in the Lancet Medical Journal shows promising results for one developed by Oxford University. The drug company AstraZeneca is preparing to mass produce the vaccine. Our medical correspondent, Fergus Walsh, has been following the trials.
So much is riding on this. Could the Oxford vaccine help end the coronavirus pandemic? More than 9,000 volunteers in the UK have received the jab. It's one of the furthest advanced of 23 COVID vaccines in clinical trials around the world. Results in the Lancet Medical Journal suggest it's safe and stimulates a response in two parts of the immune system. It prompts the creation of antibodies that should bind onto the virus and T cells, a type of white blood cell, which are able to destroy cells which have been infected. Two doses of vaccine produced a better immune response than one. Professor Andrew Pollard of Oxford University, who's leading the vaccine trials, said the results were a really important milestone.
We're really pleased with the results because we're seeing both neutralising antibody responses and T-cell responses that we are optimistic may be associated with protection. But we still need to conduct those trials to prove that that's the case in humans.
Now we need to know whether the vaccine works in the real world, either protecting against infection or by lessening the symptoms of COVID-19. Both would be a breakthrough. Trials are underway in South Africa, Brazil, and shortly in the US, all coronavirus hotspots. They may give answers before the studies in the UK, where infection rates have fallen. Dr. Elisabetta Grappelli is a virologist at St. George's University of London.
This is very good and it's very promising to start with. However, we have seen vaccines reaching this point and also failing. So we need to be a little bit careful and not quite popping the Prosecco just yet.
Another key question is whether the Oxford vaccine protects vulnerable groups such as the elderly. Immunity declines as we age, so vaccines don't usually work as well. Trials among the over 70s are underway. We also need to know how long any protection may last. Don't expect quick answers. It could be well into next year before we have definitive results on the Oxford vaccine or any others, and whether they'll provide a route out of the pandemic.
Fergus Walsh. Lydia Guthrie was one of the hundreds of people who volunteered to take part in the trial.
As a participant, I don't know anything more about what those outcomes are going to be than anybody else does. So I'm just as interested as everybody else to hear what progress has been made. And I feel really hopeful I was injected with either the experimental COVID-19 vaccine or with the meningitis A vaccine that they're using as a control on the 30th of April. And since then, I've been back to the hospital for one checkup where they checked on my general health and took a blood sample. And I guess it's those blood samples from myself and the other 499 volunteers that they've been spending the last couple of months analysing. There's a 50-50 chance that I got the experimental vaccine. For a couple of days after I got the vaccination, I did have some mild symptoms. They were just like mild flu symptoms, which the trial team warned us that we might get. Sometimes people say to me it's brave or selfless to be part of this trial, but I don't really think it's either. It's not that brave because I trust the people involved. It's also not selfless because if we find a vaccine, I will benefit just as much as anybody else. My mum lives in North Wales. I drove up to see her for a day last week, and I hadn't been able to see her since January because the rules about social distancing are stricter in Wales than they are in England. So I was able to see her for the first time, but I wasn't able to hug her, and that was really difficult. And many, many families are going through similar situations where they're not able to express their feelings for each other. So if we get a vaccine, I'll be able to hug my mum again, and that's really worth it for me.
Lydia Guthrie. To date, it's the US that has by far the highest number of coronavirus cases and deaths in the world. And the numbers keep rising. For the medical staff who are looking after the critically ill, a vaccine can't come soon enough. Dr. Joseph Farron is chief of critical care at the United Memorial Medical Center in Houston, in Texas. He told Tim Franks what it's like working on the COVID frontline.
I've been working on my COVID unit for 123 continuous days.
Good grief. How do you still function?
I don't know. I think that I'm functioning on the basis of all the adrenaline that I'm producing. We are constantly working, getting all these very sick patients. Nobody else can take care of them. So I'm really doing my best to help as many people as I can.
And presumably your intensive care unit is fairly heavily occupied.
Totally occupied. We started with a 20-bed ICU. Then we went to 46. Then we went to 58. And now we're at 88. Now, my hospital is a small hospital. It's a small community hospital of about 120 beds. So realistically, we're occupying most of the hospital.
Are you concerned at all, given that you, more than anybody else, is involved in a job which really is about life and death, that you are able to function safely?
You have a valid point, but it's very simple. People tell me, hey, why don't you take a day off? The problem is, nobody wants to work with COVID patients. You know how difficult it is to recruit nurses and to recruit doctors to come in? Nobody wants to work. And I really feel bad for my patients. It's not like I'm going to take a couple of days off and, you know, you guys are on your own. Can't do that. I'm the chief of staff of the hospital, and the hospital has literally hundreds of doctors. And only four doctors go to the COVID unit. Most of the doctors say, I'm sorry, I'm not going in. And, you know, as the chief of staff, I cannot tell them you have to go there.
Can I take you outside the ICU now and ask you about what's happening in Houston, in the state of Texas? Because there are some people who say that, astonishingly, one of the reasons for the increase in cases is because some people still are failing to take this virus seriously enough. Do you fear that that may be happening?
I'm fighting two wars. I'm fighting a war against COVID, and I'm fighting a war against stupidity, because people still either don't believe that COVID is the real thing, or even after you tell them don't do it, they go out. There is no social distancing. Let me give you an example. A couple of nights ago, I leave the hospital around 2 o'clock in the morning, and as I'm driving home, there is a little mall that is packed with cars, people having a party. I'm talking about hundreds of people having a party. They are having a great time, but there is no social distancing, no masks, no nothing. Yet I'm killing myself in the unit, trying to get people to survive, and people is just not following the rules. And in Texas in particular, there is a lot of concerns for people that says, I'm not going to use a mask. I refuse to use a mask.
And how far do you put that down to some sort of failure of leadership from those who are supposed to be in charge? I mean, I'm talking about the politicians.
Well, you know, I'm not sure that it's a failure in leadership. You know how everybody's trying to blame somebody? I think that we are all to be blamed. And especially in the U.S., you know, Americans, we seem to think that, you know, we're number one and people cannot tell us what to do. And the classic example is when we closed the state, the one thing that we didn't do at the time was education. Tell people when you reopen, you know, you need to have your social distance, wear your mask, wash your hands. We didn't do that. So everybody gets what I call cabin fever. They go to bars, they go to the beach, they go to all those places. And then 2-3 weeks later, we are suffering here in the hospitals. So if somebody was to say, okay, I'm going to make mandatory everybody stays at home now, I tell them it's worthless if you do it without education.
Dr. Joseph Farron. State-run shops in Cuba are once again selling some goods in US dollars as the country's currency crisis deepens. It's the first time dollar shops have opened since the recession that followed the collapse of the Soviet Union in the 1990s. I got more details from our correspondent in Havana, Will Grant.
It sort of comes from two different sources. The first is the very obvious one, which is the shutdown of the tourism industry middle of the coronavirus pandemic. Obviously, Cuba acted very early to shut down the entire island. That meant none of the planefuls of tourists arriving from the US, Canada, Europe, and so on. Obviously, summer holidays around the world have been sort of ended. So that's hurt Cuba's industry there very, very severely. And the second, of course, is the ramping up over the past few years by the Trump administration of the US economic embargo. Taken together, they've created really the absolute perfect storm, the economic storm for Cuba. And the decision was taken at the end of last week to allow certain goods to be purchased in US dollars. And obviously, that's a big step for the communist-run island.
How will this work?
Well, it's not like people are walking around with wadfuls of US dollars in their back pockets and paying for them in stores. There is just a handful of stores in different cities and different parts of the island that are allowed to operate in US dollars or foreign currency. But what Cubans need is a bank card that is attached to an account in a foreign currency, and then they can use that card in those stores to get those needed goods, particularly meat, dairy products, cleaning products, hygiene products. All these things are very, very scarce on the island at the moment. Foreign credit cards also work as long as they're not attached to a US bank. But obviously, critics would say this is creating a real have and have not situation on an island that is supposed to be very egalitarian. Those who have access to foreign currency through families abroad and remittances, and those who don't.
Will Grant in Havana. Still to come.
Those trans women who go through male puberty will, on average, be taller, bigger, and stronger than cisgender or typical women, even after hormone therapy.
World Rugby says it's considering a ban on transgender women competing in the female game. As you may have heard in our earlier podcast, the UK warned China it would suspend its extradition treaty with Hong Kong because of the controversial new security law it had imposed on the former British colony. China threatened tough reciprocal action, but that did not deter the UK from going ahead. Here's the Foreign Secretary, Dominic Raab, announcing the decision in Parliament.
The government has decided to suspend the extradition treaty immediately and indefinitely. And I should also tell the House that we would not consider reactivating those arrangements unless and until there are clear and robust safeguards which are able to prevent extradition from the UK being misused under the new national security legislation.
Our diplomatic correspondent James Robbins assesses the current state of relations between the UK and China.
At one level, Britain's suspension of its Hong Kong extradition treaty is little more than the formalisation of a new reality in relations with China. Even if extradition arrangements had been left in place, it was already impossible to imagine circumstances in which the UK would have sent a suspect to Hong Kong after condemning China for killing off so much of the rule of law there with its new security legislation. So is the suspension an empty gesture? No, because it sends a calculated signal challenging China. And no, because suspension, rather than permanent abandonment of the treaty, does leave open to China the option to reverse direction and restore rights to Hong Kong, even if no one expects that to happen. Will China really care? Yes, a bit, because it wants to be seen globally as a legitimate power, not just a mighty power. And today's British moves do need to be seen in the context of wider pressure coordinated with our closest allies, including Australia, Canada and the United States. But the British approach is deliberately far less punitive than the sweeping American trade sanctions against China. Boris Johnson has made clear he wants to preserve engagement with China, not least to protect trade and investment links following Brexit. Still, the overriding sense is of Britain challenging China on many fronts, Huawei, Hong Kong, and the abuse of China's Uyghur Muslim minority. In recent weeks, the government has chosen to sanction Russia and Saudi Arabia, as well as China, over human rights. Many regard that as admirable, but it's not cost-free.
James Robbins. The trick in politics is to offer compromise whilst making sure you don't give too much away. And that's just what Russian President Vladimir Putin appears to have done following a wave of public anger over the arrest of a popular governor in the Russian Far East. Mr. Putin has refused demands to reinstate Sergei Fergal, but has replaced him with someone from the same ultranationalist party. So will that be enough to end days of street demonstrations? I asked our correspondent in Moscow, Sarah Rainsford.
I think he's going to have a tough job, frankly. I mean, these are the biggest protests that we've seen in the Far East for years and years. And on Saturday, there were something like 40 to 50,000 people who took to the street in support of Sergei Fergal, and many of them against Vladimir Putin directly. So a lot of very strong statements and chants coming from the crowd. So now what Mr. Putin has done is to come up, as you say, with a compromise candidate. Mikhail Degtyaryov is from the same party as Sergei Fergal, but he's very much not him. I mean, he is a very young candidate. He's a man who appeared on state television today for a very scripted job offer from Vladimir Putin, who told him, "You're young, but you're well-educated, well-experienced. I've got a job for you," he said, a very important one, rather patronising. And then Mikhail Degtyaryov said, OK, I'm ready to fly there immediately. Just tell me what you want to do. So I think the idea that a region which is upset at having Moscow imposed to it is now having Moscow's man sent to the region, I'm not sure they're going to be entirely pleased with that.
Yeah, so how much of a challenge to Kremlin authority were these very public protests?
Well, I think they are a challenge, and I think it's an ongoing challenge, even if people leave the streets. Because I think, you know, although recently we saw, just at the beginning of this month, Vladimir Putin won the right in a national vote to run again for president for two more terms, so essentially securing himself a very long mandate, I think this is a clear sign that there are frustrations with his rule. There is increasingly a volatile environment here, and triggers like this, the most unexpected of triggers, a man accused of multiple murders being sent to remanded in prison ahead of a trial, sparking mass protests in his support. Who would have expected that? You know, it's an unusual trigger, but certainly I think it shows the volatility of the situation now, made worse by COVID-19, the effect on the economy, already a complicated situation here. So I think the Kremlin does have the jitters somewhat.
Sarah Rainsford in Moscow. We go next to Lebanon, a country on the brink of economic ruin. Its currency has lost around 80% of its value against the dollar. Prices have soared uncontrollably, and much of its middle class has been plunged into poverty. Talks with the International Monetary Fund for a bailout have faltered. And as our correspondent Martin Patience now reports from Beirut, some are turning to crime to feed their families.
I'm on Hamra Street, which is in one of the busiest shopping areas in Beirut, and I'm outside a Dunkin' Donuts. And it was here, earlier this month, in the middle of the day, that a 61-year-old man pulled out a gun, put it against his head, and pulled the trigger. His death sparked outrage in Lebanon, because a note was found close to his body, and it suggested the reason he'd taken his own life was because he was going hungry. Some Lebanese say that what happened here wasn't suicide, that it was in fact murder by the country's corrupt ruling elite. Can I just ask how the economic situation's affecting you?
Badly. Prices is going 10 times more. It's difficult to buy food, it's difficult to buy clothes, to buy everything. For my salary, I can buy less than old phone now.
For your monthly salary, yes. You can now only afford...
I'm a teacher. My basic salary is 3 million.
A year ago, that would have been about $2,000, £1,500.
Yeah.
Now, that is $200.
Yeah. Our saving money in the banks, if it's in dollar, we can touch it.
People have lost all their savings.
Yes. Situation is bad.
I have a family. We're now struggling to see the future for us, you know. And now we're coming to a point where the only solution for us is just to leave, because it's looking like you cannot live in this country anymore. The minimum things that we need are not available.
And what are they?
The minimum things you need to survive, you know, like electricity.
Money.
To buy food. Money, exactly, yeah. And there's no money. We kept having this minimum hope that things are going to get better. Things are going to get better. Things are going to get better. But I personally lost hope.
Who do you blame?
Us. I blame us. I blame myself. I blame him. I blame her. Us, you let things happen to you, you know?
It may feel that Lebanon's economic collapse has happened overnight, but the reality is it's been years in the making. The central bank here was running what critics have called a Ponzi scheme, paying ever higher interest rates to attract US dollars. And those dollars were then used to pay for imports, fancy cars, but also food, as Lebanon imports practically everything. But late last year, it became clear that the game was up, and almost half the country are now living in poverty, and some people are turning to crime.
A thief came inside this pharmacy asking for a medication, and the minute that we asked him, it cost approximately 5,000. He just got his weapon out from his pocket and put it between our eyes, asking to give him all the cash that's in our box.
Ibrahim Ambris is a pharmacist.
Are people coming into this pharmacy now and you don't have the drugs for
them? Yes, unfortunately, yes. If nothing didn't change from now till 3 months, approximately 1,500 pharmacy may close. You have to plan how to survive now, not plan how to make a good future.
What's the future of Lebanon?
What's the future of Lebanon? How can I make my children stay in Lebanon? How can I ask them to stay? If every night when I come back home, they see me in such a depressive state and nagging and saying, this is not a life. Even if I didn't speak about it, they can read it in my face.
Lebanon's fate now rests in the hands of the men, and they are all men, who have led this country for the past 30 years. Everyone here knows that things need to change, but few are hopeful that that will actually happen. As one Lebanese friend said to me, the country's leaders would rather let Lebanon burn than give up power.
Martin Patience with that report from Lebanon. World Rugby could become the first international sporting federation to ban transgender women from taking part in female competition. A draft report produced by the governing body said that trans women retain significant physical advantages which increased the risk of injury during contact rugby. Our sports correspondent Katie Gornall reports.
Earlier this year, World Rugby began a groundbreaking review of its transgender policy. It brought together scientists, medical and legal experts, as well as trans and women's groups to try to build a consensus on what is an emotive and sensitive subject. What has emerged is a draft document which proposes banning trans women from women's rugby for safety reasons. World Rugby currently follows the International Olympic Committee's policy, which states that transgender women must suppress testosterone levels for at least 12 months before competition. But in a statement, World Rugby explained that research showed this approach did not eliminate a physical advantage and presented a clear safety risk when transgender women played women's contact rugby. Dr. Nicola Williams, Director of Fair Play for Women, agrees with the proposals.
I think World Rugby are blazing a trail here that should be setting the gold standard for how sporting bodies approach this topic. Transgender people, everyone has the right to play sport, but not everyone doesn't have the right to play in any category they choose.
But there are plenty of dissenting voices. Joanna Harper is a scientist from Loughborough University who specialises in research in trans athletes and is a trans woman herself.
Those trans women who go through male puberty will on average be taller, bigger and stronger than cisgender or typical women, even after hormone therapy. And I think that putting restrictions on trans women is a reasonable thing to do. But I certainly don't agree with this idea of an outright ban.
World Rugby says it will explore appropriate participation pathways for transgender athletes. While no decision has been made, it is expected that unions will vote on this at a World Rugby Council meeting in November.
Katie Gornall. Scientists have warned that polar bears could be extinct by the end of this century if greenhouse gas emissions continue at their current rate. Researchers from the University of Toronto examined how long they could survive in the Arctic as the sea ice they depend on to hunt declines. Here's our science correspondent, Victoria Gill.
Polar bears have become the poster species for climate change because their survival is intrinsically linked to the Arctic sea ice that they use as a platform to hunt for seals. In this study, researchers modelled the fate of that ice in the coming decades. Dr. Stephen Amstrup is the chief scientist at the conservation charity Polar Bears International. He explained that at the current rate of warming, these projections showed that the frozen hunting season would become too short by the end of the century for polar bears to find enough food to survive and breed.
This is the first time that anybody has really established a timeline for when polar bears in different subpopulations around the world are likely to disappear. So what we show in the paper is that first, we're going to lose the survival of cubs. So cubs can be born, but then the female doesn't have enough body fat to produce milk to bring them along through the ice-free season. Clearly, any of us know that we can only go without food for so long. You know, that's kind of a biological reality for all species.
This stark timeline, though, is based on what's known as a business-as-usual scenario, meaning it's the predicted outcome if emissions just continue to increase. So the scientists say that if countries act to reduce emissions quickly, there's still a window of opportunity to save this Arctic predator and the frozen landscape it depends on.
Victoria Gill. And that's all from us for now, but there'll be an updated version of the Global News podcast later. If you want to send us an email, the address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. I'm Alex Ritson. Until next time, goodbye. And I'll leave you with details of another podcast you may want to listen to.
I could just hear the metal being crushed and glass shattering, and it was so, so violent.
The Outlook podcast from the BBC World Service brings you tales of ordinary people with extraordinary stories.
An average person would take around a month to shed their skin, and I shed mine in a day.
When I got to the age of 9 years old, I decided, you know what, I had enough, so I make a run for the streets.
They lined us up against the wall with their machine guns, and they said, we're going to splatter your blood against this wall like paint.
And then suddenly, I was like, wait a minute, I can't live like this for the rest of my life.
I thought, you know what? No one can tell me I'm not allowed to talk about this.
I've been dying for 19 years. For me, it was worth the shot.
There was nothing that was going to stop me.
The Outlook podcast.
If you live every day like it's your last day, you take as much as you can of it. You don't care about the consequences.
Just search for BBC Outlook, wherever you get your podcasts.